This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Session Zero Beats.
James Rivington.
David Larkins.
And the Portuguese Succession Crisis.
Big news from Mission Control. If you missed out the first time, don't panic. The wait is over. The Catstronauts board game is finally back in stock at Atlas Games.
That's right. Catstronauts sold out almost immediately on release, but the reprint has officially landed. Now you can finally bring the kitty crew home to your tabletop.
And just in time, too, because things are getting interesting on the International Space Station.
Giant laser pointers in space and a live stream of nose boops? What's not to like? Let's check out how the Catstronauts are doing up there.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Careful, Waffles. If the other Catstronauts catch you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, it's back to litter box duty for you.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady, Pom Pom is swatting at fasteners like feather toys, and Major Meowser is... napping on the instructions.
Teamwork at its finest. You can lead this kitty crew yourself in the official Catstronauts board game.
It's a cooperative challenge featuring pawsome art by the comics creator Drew Brockington, and it's perfect for gamers of all ages.
But remember, the first printing disappeared at light speed. Don't let this reprint of Catstronauts slip through your claws.
Secure your copy today at atlas-games.com/catstronauts. That's atlas-games.com/catstronauts. The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more to the windswept battlements of Elsinore Castle, and we just hope that crunch wasn't salted herring as we move once more behind Hamlet's GM screen. But we don't even need the miniatures, barely need the dice. The only thing we need is the please do not be herring flavored Doritos. And I suppose we need the comforting knowledge that Peter Frampton loves us all, but we're at session zero. We're just hanging out. We're just vibing.
We need stuff though. We need different stuff. We need the core rules. We need our character sheets, because this is the session where you, the GM, also you, the listener, are getting ready to launch a new campaign, and this seems like a purely administrative task. But once I delved into the topic in Hamlet's GM screen, which is the follow-up to Hamlet's Hit Points that takes the beat analysis system and looks at classic moments at the gaming table, it quickly became apparent that you absolutely want to continue to engage your players, even when you're just doing the admin stuff at the beginning. And that, I guess the main takeaway from this section, which I found interesting to explore, is that there's a distinction between talking to your players. And I think as GMs, sometimes we have a tendency to think, this is the beginning of the campaign. This is my chance to talk for a little bit. The difference between talking to your players and engaging your players comes out pretty quickly when you start to look at each individual moment and whether or not the players are excited and paying attention, or if possibly you've started to talk a little bit too long and they've begun to tune you out. Because when you think about people who monologue for whatever purpose, whether it be stand-up comedy or a really great lecture, you will find all sorts of ups and downs in that as well in order to keep you engaged. And you may not be, you know, Patton Oswalt or Ronald Hutton, but you do have the ability that they don't, which is to make the bit where you're introducing stuff interactive as quickly as possible. And so rather than thinking of this, first of all, as I'm going to explain everything to the players, you can start thinking of it as I'm going to throw it to the players as quickly as possible to get them asking questions so that they feel that they're participating. And if your session zero includes character generation, there'll be a section where you're going to be kind of bored while all of your players work away in parallel, being hopefully very excited about the process of creating their characters and making decisions for them and making choices. That excitement may be invisible to you, but what we're talking about here is your sort of opening salvos that get everything going before the rule books get opened.
So before this becomes Hamlet's GM screen human conversation, what's the sort of, I mean, I guess beginning with the session zero, you have to establish, you know, what you, the GM or game creator, which I guess isn't always the GM. In theory, you could have a session zero where everyone's excited about Pendragon and they're selling it to the GM. But anyway, we'll pretend it's the GM that's setting up the game. So in a session zero, you have expectations that you need to set, and you also, what else do you need to do? What are sort of your actionables, and how do you rhythmically do them?
Right. So I think the first thing to do is you've probably already pitched this to your players.
Yeah.
And they've all decided to do this, but it never hurts to reestablish expectations when everybody is sitting around the table, because it is very easy for people to project onto something that you've said a completely different tone or concept than you thought. And so this is your chance.
This is where when you say Three Musketeers, you have to explain how much romance is in Three Musketeers, because if it's the novel, it's a great deal of romance. And in many players' expectations, it should just be sword fighting, and you have to sort of set that up.
Right. Or, you know, you may have said this is a satirical science fiction dystopia, and one of the players, you know, just didn't lock into the satirical part and they were all ready for something very serious. And so this is your chance to sort of address mistaken.
They're bringing Warhammer 40K to your Brazil game.
Exactly. Although both are satirical, come to think of it.
Yeah. But also will not mash together.
No. Two separate things. And so when you're just re-explaining everything, explaining your tone, explaining what's going on in the game, what the genre is, what the expectations are, if you can get that into a Q&A format as quickly as possible, the questions that are asked by the players will have the same impact beat-wise as a question that comes up in the course of the narrative, which is a question creates tension. It's a mystery, something that hasn't been resolved. And so therefore, that moves the arrow down. It creates tension and suspense. And an answer to that question often creates an up arrow, a complementary up arrow, because the suspense, the tension has been relieved with an answer. The difference here is that whether it's an up or down beat is also determined by how much the expectations answer conforms with the expectations that the player already had, right? So the player who came in thinking this was a serious dystopia, when they ask the question that reveals to them that it's in fact satirical, they may be somewhat disappointed for a moment because they have to readjust their expectations. And this gets to the fact that in this early stage, when it is the players you're interacting with, not the players playing their characters who are concerned for the fate of their characters, the up arrows point toward hope, as usual, the hope that everybody's going to have a good time and it's going to be a super great campaign. But the down arrow is more toward frustration than fear, right? When you're a player asking what's going to happen in the game, you're not afraid of anything because you don't have a character yet to be afraid for, but you may be frustrated if you don't understand the answer to a question, or you find the answer too vague, or if it's an answer that you didn't really want that forces you to readjust what it is that you're doing.
Yeah, you might be afraid that, oh no, this is going to be another campaign that spirals out into nothing like the last two. And so that's, I guess, the fear as well, which is sort of like frustration. Right. Fear of frustration. Is it frustration? Is it fear? Science can't say. So as you are doing the sort of, you know, expectation setting, questions and answers, is this like this? No, it's more like this. At some point, you start explaining the rules, or at the very least, we're going to use this subset of the rules, because very few people are going to play a game, for a campaign at least, with a session zero as written. And, you know, what source books are we using? That kind of stuff. And how do you make that anything more than a little nap beat where everyone zones out because no one cares?
Right. And I think these days with a lot of groups, the assumption that anybody has read the rules yet is, you know, one person has read the rules.
It's optimistic and they're the rules keener.
They have different questions than everybody else. So yeah, you would think, oh no, here's a part where I just have to provide big blocks of information. And the question instead is to, first of all, describe them in an exciting way that envisions the sorts of things they'll be doing in the game. So use lots of examples, first of all, when you're describing the rules. But also, you may want to think about how much of the rules does everybody need for session zero. There's no point in explaining the combat rules if there's no combat this session. Nothing's going to happen this session in the story. In fact, maybe you won't get to a fight until, you know, session two. So I would strongly advise the sort of rules demo approach where you wait until a rule becomes important before you try to explain it. And that just shortens the amount of monologue and makes it easier for you to keep making it interactive with them. The flip side of that, I guess, is a very rules intensive game that assumes that you will achieve system mastery. But in that case, if you've actually explained to everybody that this is the kind of game that we're playing and that the onus is on them to actually read the rules before they generate right. their characters.
Oh, Pathfinder.
Yeah, exactly. That's a whole right. Different thing. So the amount of homework you assign people is another question. So if you have, if you're playing a crunchy F20 game, you know, you're going to need to know the rules in order to pick your feats or whatever it is. Make sure you do that. And that is kind of on you and on you to do, hopefully, on your own, because everybody sitting there reading the rules together is means you will have two session zeros, basically.
Yeah.
Realistically, these days, a lot of people do show up at the session. The only time I have for this game is when I'm at this game. And so that may be an extended thing, but I think that's part of why busy people gravitate toward simpler systems, right?
And also, most good F20 games, that's what the fighter is for. You got one class or one sort of thing that you're playing where it isn't super rules mastery, and you do basically only need to know how does combat work and a couple of other things. And with a, I mean, one of the, talk about your upbeats, the, yes, I will let you adjust your feats if after, you know, the first level or the first bunch of combats, you've determined that your feat is not doing what you thought your character would do, and you can go ahead and retcon it. I think that that, you know, takes some of the onus off as well. And so, offering flexibility is another upbeat, especially in a game system where you approach it with a bit of the old fear, the old downbeat, maybe. And so I think that's another way to do an upbeat. And then I guess the other thing is that the other thing you're doing is warning people off types of character that are going to drive them right into a rules thicket. So they may say, I want to play, you know, the Decker in Shadowrun. And even if you believe the Decker rules work in your particular edition of Shadowrun, that's still going to involve a lot more jiggery pokery than Orc with Club Go Smash.
Right. You're paying for a moment of disappointment when you say, I don't think you want to play the Decker.
Yeah.
You're avoiding many sessions down the line, many more frustration downbeats as you break out of character to figure out the rules. And so, yeah, this is a moment where you can sort of guide people toward the level of rules engagement that they want. But while you do that, do it in a positive way that sounds fun. It's like, hey, Reg, you like to come and show up at the last minute and do something kooky. So obviously, you're going to want to be the rogue. And I advise that you take the backflip. Because I think you're going to really enjoy playing a backflippy sort of character. And so you might want to use certain examples to sort of heighten people's ability to picture what's going to happen in play, kind of sell it to them. And that gives them upbeats, even as you're providing them the information and doing it in a positive way. You want to play the thief, not you shouldn't play the Decker, right?
Right, yeah. And so we sort of touched on setting when we talked about expectations, but as a guy who starts with Earth, I have learned, even with University of Chicago graduate students, you cannot begin, rattle, hutton, or no, with the lengthy lecture setting out the geopolitical complexities and court intrigues and everything that you think they might need to know. So short of writing them a reading list, something I would certainly never do, he said, looking over his reading list. What's your suggestions for keeping the setting exploration in session zero, you know, a variegated beatly?
So I would start off with what is relevant to their characters that they're going to need for the next session. And so you want to sort of quickly give the basics, make it fun, and highlight what it is that they're doing. So the question is not, you know, what was the geopolitical situation like in the 7th century, but what do you, a mercenary and a trickster and a druid, know about the world? And what is it that is going to motivate you about the world to go out and do things? And so once you have people's character concepts, you can tailor the information to them and sort of weave in their motivational hooks into the information that they absolutely need to know, and then throw it to questions so that, right, again, it becomes interactive. And instead of answering the question that you think is most interesting, which is about the collapse of the fisheries in 632, they can say, so I'm a boatman. What kind of boat do I have? And they, oh, well, the boat building in this village is a big deal, and you're known for your boat. And again, begin to bring in character notes and sort of turn it into a prologue of pre-story that hooks those specific characters in and roots them so that it is less of a history lecture.
And once you're rooting characters, that gets into stuff that we've talked about before, about, you know, if you all grew up in the same village, do you know each other? Who likes who best? Who has family obligations to each other? Those sorts of things that turn you from random guys who met at a tavern, not that there's anything wrong with that, to a cohesive group with a reason to stick together for adventure number two and beyond, right?
Right. And because you're creating an emotional web, it has the word emotional right in it. It's about caring about these characters and each other. Yeah. And so that is a process that, like several processes we'll encounter as we look at the different parts of a game through the beat analysis system, that already work because designers took the effort to envision them and make them work.
And then finally, this is something we've talked about before, but to round off session zero, just make sure that every character's got a reason to be doing adventures as opposed to sticking home and fishing. So you do the standard, why would you be going after the Kraken? Or why would you be going inland to fight, you know, the legendary giant or whatever sort of question? Why are you an adventurer instead of a smart person who stays in the village and woos the Fair Marguerite?
Right. And again, that's story already. The actual beginning where they get their mission or decide what it is that they're going to do, that's going to happen next week. But you've already got them envisioning their characters, thinking about them, beginning to feel that they're alive. And now all of a sudden, the lateral beats of just a pure administrative session have turned into up and down beats, and people are excited and engaged. And then they're going to crack open their rule books, and you can use that time instead of waiting for everybody to finish, do a little bit of homework yourself and, you know, review your adventure for next week or work on some monster stats or whatever it is, or draw a map so that you're not just sitting there waiting for them, feeling frustration while they're all super engaged.
Yeah. Well, I think we've talked previously about turning that into a part of the Q&A as they build characters, is like, I want to take the archer feat. And you say, well, if you're an archer, you're probably from this part of the kingdom, or you probably have this kind of background or whatever. And that lets you feed them more story while also nudging their character toward the idea of the kind of game that you thought you were running in the first place.
Well, speaking of nudging, it's time for us to nudge ourselves through an exciting commercial message to whatever hut or segment waits on the other side.
In a hole in the ground, they found a body.
I know! Here we are in Maryshire, right in the middle of the beautiful bucolic riding.
So bucolic.
With its neat hedgerows, and picturesque taverns, and delightful crumpet shops, and quaint little village greens.
Can we go back to the crumpets?
Yes, yeah, so what did you want to know about them?
I wanted to have some crumpets and shut off the recording.
Okay, let's do that.
Okay, we're back. What were we saying?
Murder!
Murder?
Yes, we've got murder to solve.
In the bucolic riding? Where all the halflings live?
Yes, the halflings. Plus also some boggarts, pukas, and dwarves. But weren't we concerned concerned about something?
Murder?
Yes, murder! Another case in need of sleuthing by a team of amateur detectives.
It would be unthinkable if this wasn't the third murder this week.
Mary Shear Detective Club is a fantasy mystery-solving RPG.
By the master of fantasy and mystery.
And fantasy mystery.
Gareth Ryder Hanrahan.
Investigate crimes, question eccentric neighbors, stop for tea and cakes, unravel puzzles, and get involved in pedantic arguments about jam.
Wait, what kind of jam?
In the most adorable,
but still murdery,
gumshoe game yet, you gather clues, uncover motives, follow gossip, question suspicious neighbors, stop for lunch, get sidetracked, remember you're supposed to be solving a case, gather some more clues, question more eccentric locals,
possibly chase a swan or something,
and slowly piece together the truth.
Coming soon to Backer Kit from Pelgrane Press.
Type Backer Kit and Mary Shear into your favorite search engine to find the launch page. The retinal scan that we underwent in order to gain clearance to enter the skiff. Oh, wait a minute. No, we're going back in time in the Tradecraft Hut to when there were no technical means of figuring out who was a spy and who wasn't. There were mere documents and rumors, because this Tradecraft Hut we're going to use as a reminder to everybody that the crowdfund is coming up for The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, which is the Nations and Canons book. You can sign up for your launch notification at yourdadwilllovethis.com. And as you do, you can think about the career of James Rivington. Tristan Zimmerman of Nations and Canons suggested him to us. And the problem is we're not really sure whether he was a spy or not, but that's the whole point. That's what makes you a great spy, is if nobody was sure if you're a spy or not. So Ken, tell us all about James Rivington, who may or may not have been a spy.
Yeah. Well, he's born in 1724 in London. He is the son of a bookseller and publisher, which was a more common business organization then than it is now. But true to being a publisher, he squandered all of his money and blew it at the races at Newmarket. And so rather than be poor in England, he sailed to America and opened up his bookshop in Philadelphia. Didn't like, I guess, the vibes of Philadelphia because he moved to New York really fast and opened up a new printing shop on Wall Street in 1761. By 1773, he has moved from Wall Street to Hanover Square, a couple of blocks south, and has begun publishing a weekly newspaper known as the New York Gazetteer. And very exciting it was. It became a sort of opinion journal that everyone wanted to contribute to or read. And as he kept publishing, it began as sort of, you know, we will take on all opinions. We will publish anything. We are a free press. And then it slowly drifts ever more Tory as the colonies themselves drift ever less Tory and more patriot. And this, because New York is really the center of Tory sentiment in America, may be an early case of subscriber capture, right? Now,
right.
You know, a modern day news organization can't move too far from what its subscribers want to see. So it sort of neglects those stories and does other stories. And this happens over and over in the history of news.
And nobody needs editorials more than the people who are losing the argument.
Exactly. By 1774, various patriot assemblies have been loudly canceling their subscription. Again, very modern. The New York Gazetteer still claims a circulation of 3,600 in October of 74. And given that the New York population then was 25,000, that's the equivalent of like 1.1 million subscribers now. And that is a little less than the New York Times had at its peak. So he's a pretty influential newspaperman. Don't be fooled by that seemingly tiny number. So he's so influential that the Sons of Liberty in New Jersey hang him in effigy in 1775 as the revolution heats up. And the Sons of Liberty in New York say, well, rather than effigying, let's just burn his printing press down. And so he flees the implicit threat of death by arson to the British sloop of war, the HMS Kingfisher. His assistants keep publishing the Gazetteer with him on deck, negotiating with the government of New York for a pardon and a free pass. And the government of New York says, yeah, sure, step off the deck. Nothing bad will happen to you. And then the Sons of Valerie burn down the new printing place and melt his lead type down for bullets, which I feel is the kind of hint that if you are a journalist with your finger on the pulse of the population, you pick up. And so
it's a threat and a metaphor all at once.
Exactly. So he stays on the boat, or at least goes to a different boat and sails to England. And in 1776, he's in England and he gets the sinecure of King's Printer for New York. £100 a year, not bad money in 1776. And in 1777, now that the hated British have occupied New York and driven bold General Washington out of it, he sails back to New York City and reopens his paper in his old shop at Hanover Square as Rivington's New York Loyal Gazette. And then he puts the royal arms on the masthead, and in case people don't get the point, he just changes the name to the Royal Gazette. So royal, yeah. Even better than loyal, frankly.
And his slogan, monarchy dies in darkness.
Exactly. 1778, the Royal Gazette goes biweekly, by which we mean twice a week, not the other kind of biweekly. At some point during the British occupation, Rivington opens a coffee house next door to his shop, which becomes a gathering place for British officers. And we know that it's opened by 1781 because the main coffee house starts advertising in various papers as the real coffee house, not just a place that serves coffee, but a place for people of society to be. So Merchant's Coffee Shop is mad enough at Rivington that they take an ad out in his own paper to say that their coffee shop is better. So we know that's in 1781. In 1783, the British, having lost the war, evacuate New York City, but he stays, and everyone is surprised, and they are even more surprised that Continental soldiers guard his print shop for him for some reason. He changes the name of the paper. Oh, right, yeah, to Rivington's New York Gazette and Universal Advertiser. But A, not a lot of advertisers in his paper, and B, the Sons of Liberty keep, you know, I don't know if they beat up a man who is now edging 60, but they probably shove him around and make mean noises in their mouth when he goes into a bar. So eventually the paper folds and he dies in 1802 in poverty and obloquy, known as the King's Printer, usually with a hiss. And everyone reads the good old New York Post, founded by consummate patriot Aaron Burr.
Right. But this isn't the printer hut.
No.
This is the tradecraft hut. So what about his possible other life?
So as early as 1784, rumors begin showing up in letters and diaries that he had been one of Washington's spies, and that's why he didn't leave with the rest of the British. That's why he had an armed guard on his place, as opposed to a preventing fire reason.
Yes.
And this rumor builds and builds until it shows up in the memoirs, the 1860 memoirs, posthumously published, of George Washington's step-grandson, George Washington Custis. And he gives us the best spy tech part of the story, which is that Rivington would write his reports on thick cardboard and then bind them into the covers of the books that he sold in his shop. And either he would sell those books to known people, or he would take the book guy, his jobber, and say, go, you know, get these in a New Jersey bookstores. And the guy would go, and then Washington would send a guy to that bookstore and buy the books that, you know, just came in from Rivington's press. And then they'd bust them open and they'd read the special code message. Custis also gives us an urban legend of Washington going to Rivington's print shop during the occupation, you know, accompanying the soldiers who are going to guard it. And he shows up and he says, I've heard that Rivington is quite the fellow. And of course, Rivington had been writing essays and editorials about how awful Washington was. So that's sort of a bit. And then, according to a guy who told it to Light Horse Harry Lee, Washington went into the back room with Rivington and they heard something heavy and clinking being dropped on a table. And then Washington came out and said, we're done here, boys. And they moved on. And so the theory is that he paid him off for being a spy for America with a big purse of gold. Later on, we found the code book of Washington's for sure spy master, a guy named Benjamin Talmadge, and this was his 1779 code book, and Rivington is in it as number 726, so he has a code number, but Lord North also has a code number, so just having a code number doesn't prove you're a spy.
And remind people who Lord North is.
Well, Lord North is George Germain, the hated first minister of the hated British, and the architect of our oppression and the attempted architect of our suppression, and also a coward at the Battle of Minden, while I'm just throwing things around about Lord North. But Rivington is also in that notebook in the spy section, not the sources or guys to watch section. But the core Culper ring guys all have code names, like Joseph Culper, and Rivington doesn't have a code name. He has a number. So that notebook is not dispositive. But turns out the guy who was the silent partner in that coffee house is a guy named Robert Townsend, or as he is also known, Culper Jr. And so therefore, an American spy is funding this coffee house, which again is full of British officers spreading news and information that George Washington would very much like to know. So by 1781, it is almost definite. I would say a historian is now climbing uphill if they say he's not a spy at this point, because a guy who is Washington's liaison with the French Admiral Comte de Grasse, a cavalryman named Alan McLean, has two letters, one from him and one to another guy that he kept in his letters, that confirmed that a person in Rivington's printing house, also noted in the anonymous letter as R in New York, and McLean's own letter says, through the assistance of the noted Rivington, they secured the British naval codes, and McLean passed them on to the Comte de Grasse, the French admiral. And that is a big get.
Right. And so he's basically citing the reliability of this information by giving away the name of the informant.
Right. Yeah. Although he gave it away to the guy that he worked for, which is a guy named Peters. And that guy sent the letter to Washington that said, I have a guy in Rivington's press. I can't tell you anymore, but we got the naval codes through that guy. And Washington then writes back and says, that's a good source. We should cultivate him, implying that he doesn't actually start being a spy until 1781, which is why I would really like to know when he opened that coffee house, because we only know that it's opened in 1781. But obviously, if it's opened with American spy money in 1779, that's, you know, that's indicative of something.
Right. It would still make sense if you open a coffee shop in order to make money selling coffee and then realize,
right,
oh, wait, all the British officers are here flapping their lips. You know, you could still say, would you like to invest in my spy-worthy coffee shop? I guess
right.
That'd be another question that could have been asked.
And it may also be we would like to invest in your spy-worthy coffee shop, and if you don't let us, we will tell the British that you're a spy for us. Which is how many people have been coerced into being an asset.
Yes, the old carrot and stick method.
So the people who are now saying, sure, he was a spy, it's absolute, we've proven it, you know, exclamation point, people will then say, well, why didn't he say, I was a spy for Washington. Please stop burning down my shop. Please advertise in my newspaper. Why isn't that page one of the first issue of the Not at All Loyal Gazette? And in 1782, as it transpires, the British governor of New York, Sir Guy Carleton, commissioned both of Rivington's sons, who are 9 and 10, as British officers, so they could keep collecting half pay. And this is an obvious payoff for Rivington's services to the crown as a propagandist. However, if he then publishes a big, ha-ha, I was Washington's spy, they probably get their half pay stopped by the British, you know, military, or at least they get decommissioned. So that's why he keeps quiet, and his sons outlive him, and that's why he keeps quiet for his whole life. And that's the argument there. So we are left with almost certainly Rivington was a spy, if not some unknown person in Rivington's print shop whose name doesn't show up in any of Talmadge's documents or in the letter was a spy. But it's, I think, like I say, it's an uphill climb now to say that he wasn't a spy. There's a letter from Robert Morris, one of the financiers of the Revolution, who is saying, hey, if I have a friend in New York City who would like a preemptive pardon for stuff he's doing, but it's okay, he's a spy for us, who do I apply to for that? And everyone says, ha ha, there we are. That's proof that Rivington was a spy in 1779 when Morris is writing this letter. And other historians say, one person in New York, this does not narrow it down to Rivington, given that we know that lots of people in New York were spies for Washington, hence there being a Culper ring, for example. So I don't know that we can go as early as 1779. Some people have said that. My guess is closer to 1780, 81.
Well, that certainly gives you the flavor of espionage in this era and the great detail of the information hidden in the books. I imagine your nations and canons player characters would like to pick up those books, whether they're intercepting them on purpose or stumble across them by accident. So,
and one of the fun things that they can be doing is if they're in New York in 1780 and they're at the coffee shop, is Rivington a spy? They don't know. So it can be a little ironic distance for the player as well as for the character.
Right. And they can certainly go into the coffee shop and try to seem like loyalists and listen in pretty hard and see what they learn. Exactly. Well, I know what we're going to learn, and that is that there's an exciting commercial message to listen to, and then another HUD and or segment.
Play The King in Yellow has haunted imaginations like a dirge since its first appearance in 1895.
But among the fortune tellers of Europe, the play was not the fearful beginning of something new, but the culmination of something older, The King in Yellow Tarot.
Daniel Harms and John Scott Tynes, famous clairvoyants, divined the form's importance of this Carcosan deck.
Painter Kurt Komoda, in a fevered fugue of inspiration, reproduced designs thought long lost.
Spread the cards.
Let the King in Yellow tell your fate.
There is no other who could.
After all, you have seen the yellow sign.
The King in Yellow Tarot is a complete deck of 78 cards in full color.
Sturdy cards with a soothing, silky finish.
Inspired by the works of Robert W. Chambers.
An accompanying 28-page guide explores the history of the deck and recommends, hesitantly, its technique.
A complete PDF of cards and guide comes with your order.
Add to cart at shop.arcdream.com.
That's your reality shattered cart at shop.arcdream.com. Save this podcast from getting zeroed out alongside such beloved Patreon backers as...
Sean Stevenson,
Steve Sigaty,
Tom Abella,
Bill Serwan,
and Chuck Reynolds.
It's time once more for Ken and or Robin talk to someone else. And today, I, Ken, am at ChupacabraCon in semi-sunny, or actually very sunny, San Marcos, Texas. And I'm talking to someone else, and the someone else I'm talking to is David Larkins, who, amongst other tremendous accomplishments that we will hopefully get to, is the line developer for Pendragon, or as Jeff Richard pronounces it, Pendragon.
Yes.
So I guess to begin with, what is the canonical pronunciation of Pendragon? And tell me about Pendragon.
Yeah, you know, and I go with Pendragon.
There
so,
we go. There's
so you're line developer. Different ways to do it.
All right.
Yeah. But yeah, Jeff is, I think, the only person in the world who pronounces it that way.
Right. Well, I'm sure there must be some Welshman somewhere who does it. But I'm glad that we are canonically on the Ken and David are right team.
Yeah.
So one of the dream gigs in gaming, I've known previous developers for the line, and they're all terrific people. You're a terrific people. What got you into Pendragon to begin with, and what raised you to your current dizzying heights, I guess? Give us the quest of David Larkins.
Yeah, indeed. You know, I ran across the game back in the 90s, and it was totally up my alley. I love Arthurian, you know, legends, fantasy, you know, folk tales, medieval history, you name it, right? Mm-hmm. And it was ticked all the boxes. And so started playing it avidly about 25 years ago. And, you know, Greg Stafford, creator of Pendragon, was a very accessible guy. He was all about sort of interacting with fans. And so I crossed paths with him a few times and heard that he was looking for people to just proofread some of the manuscripts he was working on. This was about, 12, 13 years ago. And so that's kind of how I connected with him. And, you know, I normally would say, don't ever give away your work for free. But I kind of figured with Greg Stafford, you know, you can make an exception.
Well, there were periods of Greg's life where that was the only way to do
it. That was the only way to do it. Exactly. Exactly so.
But there was no money in it.
That's right. Yes. And this was back when, you know, the rights to Pendragon were kind of a little ephemeral. You know, they had been picked up outside of Chaosium, and Greg was sort of self-publishing within that remit. So, yeah, I was happy to help out. And, yeah, and then, you know, I just developed a relationship with Greg. And Greg was all about sort of facilitating what people wanted to do. And so, you know, at one point he asked me, you know, where do you see yourself going with your work on Pendragon? And I said, well, I'd love to be line editor one day. And he said, well, that's my job. And I thought, oh man, I've really blown it. And then he called me up about a year later and he said, you know, I'm thinking of retiring. Would you are you still interested in that gig? And, you know, I said, yeah, of course. So it's a lesson in just sort of putting out into the world what you want, and you might get it.
Yeah. So you are literally Bedivere standing there by the shores of the lake.
You got it.
He gives you Excalibur.
Absolutely.
And in this case, it says, don't throw it away.
Yeah. It's the part where it's the version of the legend where I don't throw it into the lake.
Right.
And I come back and I go, yeah, I totally threw it in the lake.
Yeah. And he's like, cool. So yeah, you've got Excalibur now. You're heading out to rebuild Camelot.
Mm-hmm.
What is, I mean, Pendragon now has just come out with, is it sixth edition?
This yes.
New one?
Yeah. Sixth edition.
And what did you do between being handed Excalibur and sixth edition?
Yeah.
That, you know, what new heights are you reaching? Or is it still, you're just trying to get back to first edition and the pure beauty and power of 1984 Pendragon?
Yeah, exactly.
What's your sort of approach to that? Because obviously there's sort of two ways to go. Is Pendragon was so far ahead of its time in 1984 that just going back to that counts as a radical shift in many cases.
Right.
But also, there are new gaming technologies that have been developed since then, a very few.
Yeah.
Some of them even worthy of being included in Pendragon.
Yeah.
Where do you see your version of Pendragon? Are you going backward to Camelot or forward to Camelot, I guess, is the question.
Right, right. Well, I'm definitely stewarding Greg's legacy on the game. You know, shortly before he passed, he in 2018, he had completed the sort of first draft, first pass manuscript of sixth edition.
Uh-huh.
And the way he described it was that was his ultimate edition. It was the magnum opus of his magnum opus.
Right.
So, you know, what followed from there was just developing that very rough first draft into publishable books, mm-hmm. which, as you know, can take a while. And so that's kind of what we've been doing is rolling, you know, we published the starter set in 2023, the core rule book in 2024, Game Master's Handbook 25, and then we're this year publishing quite a bit, actually.
Yeah, Boy King.
Yeah, the Boy King, and also the Noble's Handbook, which is going to complete the set of the sort of original core, because it was like either do a three-volume core set or 800-page rulebook.
Right,
which, yeah. You know, wasn't going to work.
At some level, it makes both economic and physical sense
yes.
to split them up.
Yes, exactly.
So the Boy King is coming out this year.
Mm-hmm.
And is this another example of if we published Great Pendragon Campaign, it would be 1,000 pages and we need to split it back the way that it was split back in the 80s?
Yeah.
Or is there some other aesthetic goal rather than just don't break the spine?
It's that's always a good goal. It's a new edition of the Great Pendragon Campaign. And
right.
so therefore, obviously, there's going to be more material. There's material that Greg was working on. There's material that I've contributed. Some of his other longtime contributors have put in there. So it's really just, kind of improving on perfection is what we're trying to do, mm-hmm. you know, because, I mean, the Great Pendragon Campaign obviously is, for those who don't know.
For those poor, pitiable people.
Yeah.
It is the greatest single role-playing campaign ever written or designed.
Yeah, exactly.
End of story.
Yeah.
Mass of Nyarlathotep is in the conversation as well.
Yes.
But Great Pendragon Campaign is, it's literally the Mort D'Arthur mm-hmm. of Pendragon.
Yes.
It is the Summa. It is the Idols of the King. It is the Ring Cycle. It is as complete and pure a piece of work as anything ever has been. And I mean, that's just the notion of, you know, we're adding 30% to the Morton Arthur. That's a challenge, right? How do you pick, right? What makes it worthy of being in the new edition as opposed to being, you know, down in a supplement somewhere with the peasants and the scullery maids?
Right. It's sort of like, so one example would be, there's the Battle of Badon.
Right.
Okay. And since the Boy King starts in 510, and you're playing one scenario per game year, generally, you'll be 8 scenarios into the campaign by the time you get to Badon. Mm-hmm. Well, Badon is literally, the advice in there is kill the player characters. You know, right, like if you don't get 50%, you know, kills, you're not doing it right.
You didn't Badon correctly.
Well, if you're, you know, planning a longer term campaign, that's a little early to be TPKing your group, right? So we have a little alternate scenario now. That's sort of a fetch quest. Go get the adventurous shield for Arthur and bring it back. And, you know, that way he can use it in the battle. And then you got to get it back to the monastery before the avenging angel comes down and murks you for it, you know. So kind of adding some extra play options, you know, that kind of thing. And just sort of adding some extra context, some background, that kind of thing. Because, you know, Greg was very deeply immersed in the scholarship, as you were saying. And, you know, this is kind of his synthesis of all Arthurian legend. And so just from, you know, this was published 20 years ago. So we have 20 years of gameplay to kind of go, where were the spots where people would get hung up? Where were the spots people get a little confused?
We need a little bit of explication for people who are not Greg.
Exactly.
Yeah. And the other thing about Pendragon campaign originally, part of why it was physically possible was the sort of amazing to me as a designer concision of those adventures.
Yeah.
You had not just one adventure per year, but maybe one page per adventure or 2 pages per adventure.
Absolutely.
And to me as a designer, that has been a goal to emulate and strive for. Mm-hmm. But maybe your goal is that people want a little more breathing room. Mm-hmm. Is it basically that rather than 2 pages per year, we're going to luxuriate in 6 pages per year? Is that sort of the
basic
approach?
Yeah, exactly. You know, we had a little bit more room to play with because this is going to be a 3-volume set. So, you know, that way we can get into a little bit more. My whole philosophy, to kind of get back to your earlier question with developing the line for 6th edition, is accessibility. You know, I want the game to be as accessible as possible to newcomers to the game. So modularity is a goal, where if you just want to get the starter set, and like the Grey Knight, and those kind of dovetail together, and you can play 6 game years worth of adventures with just those 2 products, and that's good for you, great. I love it.
You've played Pendragon, you can mark it off, and you can move on to some other thing.
Exactly that, yeah.
But part of the thing that makes Pendragon so special is that generational play.
Yeah.
The part where you're embedded into the society and responding to it, and it's responding to you.
Yeah.
Is that something that you think that gamers with shorter attention spans, let us say politely, will respond to? Or is this just pearls before swine?
Well, hopefully not that. But
swine in a good way. Swine, well, parentheses, complimentary.
Exactly. You know, what's the survey anecdote? It's like, oh, the average campaign lasts 12 to 18 sessions or whatever.
Right, yeah.
You know? That's another thing with the new sort of multi-volume approach of the Great Pendragon campaign, is that each book covers about 18 to 20 game years.
Right.
So you can totally just do 1 volume. You can do 2 volumes. You can do all 3, whatever you want to do, you know. And then if you're doing all 3 volumes, great. Now you're doing the multi-generational game.
Right.
Yeah.
Because half of you died at Badon.
Yeah. Yeah. And the Noble's Handbook has one of my favorite little bits. Greg did this whole extended family mechanic where you find out what your aunts and your uncles and your nieces and nephews and sisters and brothers are all up to, but you leave the cousins blank, and that's because that's your replacement pool.
Right.
Yeah. Cousin A is going to come in here and be your new character.
Be you.
Yeah.
Is there a place, I mean, because a lot of this is sort of shoring up the old edition and old material for a new edition and for new players.
Yeah.
Is there a place you want to take Pendragon sort of out of that shadow and into a new space? Or is your contention, which would be a completely legitimate contention, that Pendragon was already perfect in 1984. We don't need to add World War I biplanes or some other
right.
thing to it. I mean, Paladin is a wonderful product, playing the Paladin. And even back in the 80s, they did the Beowulf campaign, which was an astonishingly good product.
Yeah.
Is there areas that you're looking at as line developer going forward, or is that too misty to even foresee?
Oh, no. Yeah. We have a couple of, fully developed manuscripts. We have a sort of medieval Japan, not Kurosawa era, but, sort of earlier period, dawn of the samurai.
Right.
Heroic Greece is another one, Trojan War era. We're talking about doing the Ring Cycle maybe at some point, So yeah, like you say, I mean, Pendragon is a great engine for, find a myth cycle.
Right. Yeah.
And you can do something with it. And then, like, even for the core game, next year we're going to have a bestiary written by Graham Davis that's coming out that Pendragon's never had a bestiary before.
Wow.
Yeah.
Maybe, I mean, that alone is quite an accomplishment to have been going on since 84 and never had done a monster book.
Yeah, I know, right?
but it does seem like a natural hole to fill.
Yeah.
In the great era of Pendragon, one of the reasons that I early on recognized it as something different and special was the "you can't be a magician" rule.
Yeah.
Now, I think that's sort of softened and wavered a little bit in Sixth. Am I wrong?
Well, we will eventually have a magic book coming out.
Okay.
And the way we're approaching it, because in Fourth Edition, you could be a magician.
Right. Yeah. I remember that there was one edition where it's like, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
That seems like Satanism to me.
Seems a little dodgy.
Right.
The magic book is really kind of like, here's a deep dive on pagan magic. So, druids, ladies of the lake, also sorceresses and sorcery, angry clerks and frustrated noblewomen learning magic, teaching themselves magic,
People who get a hold of Saracen books.
Exactly. Very that.
Do that book learning that we don't like.
Exactly. They know how to read. And so there's that for game masters to, we have every sort of magic item that was written, that was mentioned in the medieval romances, is in that book.
Right.
And then there's rules for if you want to do a magician as a supporting character. So this is never going to be your main player character.
Right.
Not your knight, but
you might have a court magician.
Exactly.
Your own little sub Merlin.
Exactly. Who can show up and help out, or even take over for a session and be the game master character who's sort of the quest initiator.
Right. Okay. That's actually a really fun approach to it.
Yeah.
Is that you have a rotating pool of Merlins you can draw from if you need to.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's just great to know that Pendragon is back and, going gangbusters. Is there another thing coming out that you want to tease and taunt people with that I haven't even thought to ask?
Well, I'm currently hard at work on the next. So we've got the Boy King, then we're going to have the High King, and then we're going to have the Fallen King. That's our trilogy.
Right.
So I'm currently hard at work on the High King. That'll be out next year. The Bestiary I already mentioned. And we're also doing Knights and Ladies Adventurous, which is sort of an expanded character creation book, lots of new options and that kind of thing.
Right.
So, yeah. And I've got enough stuff in my production queue that we're going to be pretty much booked out to 2028, 29,
Fantastic.
So, yeah. Yeah.
And for the Uther stands, yes. I guess, where's the pre-king? Where does that come from?
Well, I would love to do sort of a prequel trilogy that starts with Vortigern.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So all the way back. Right.
And then if you're really mad, you can do all six volumes and have your 130-year campaign or whatever.
Fantastic. Yeah. And I guess that leaves me then to pitch the Sons of Troy.
Yes.
When they arrive in London and kill off all the giants and build the towers.
Absolutely.
The earliest Geoffrey of Monmouth,
back when he's
doing his own fantasy. So this is wonderful. I cannot tell you how happy I am to see Pendragon back where it belongs, riding high, and how grateful I am that you have shouldered the lance and are wielding Excalibur with a good will. So thanks so much, David, for saving one of the greatest games ever and for continuing the good fight.
Thank you, Ken. I really appreciate that.
Right. And thanks for coming on the show as well.
Of course.
The British are coming!
The Kickstarter campaign is almost upon us for Flagbearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
The Kickstarter campaign also features a revised core book supporting play in other eras, a supplement about political scheming within the two sides of the war, and years of maps, supplements, splat books, and adventures following the war from Boston to Yorktown.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
This Kickstarter is the best time ever to get into Nations and Cannons.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at yourdadwilllovethis.com. The clacking of time gears and the whirring of chronotons tell us we're once more standing in proximity to Kent's time machine. This, of course, is the conveyance that his superiors at Time Incorporated used to send him back into history to bend, fold, spindle, and sometimes even mutilate it. And this time around, we've got another one of those questions where we're going to see what the alternate timeline looks like and then see whether you want to preserve the current timeline or change it. But they've been thinking about a thing that happened in Portugal in 1580, and that thing is that Portugal fell under the influence for, I guess, a couple of generations, not the influence, but the rule of the Spanish crown, because they made the biggest mistake you can possibly make in the monarchical system, which is they ran out of monarchs.
Yep.
Portugal at this time has a global reach, which includes Brazil, Macau. They've got a gold-producing region in Zimbabwe. They've got Goa. Speaking of topical, they've got the control of the Strait of Hormuz. And you will see a lot of arguments. Is this really an empire? Was it a thinly stretched empire? Was it just a series of commercial outposts? But it was valuable, and that existence changed history throughout the world. For example, it's why Portuguese, unexpectedly, is one of the most spoken languages. So, Ken, take us into this bit of, I don't know, carelessness that led them to not have a proper monarch to continue their independence.
Yeah. And just as a sidebar on the is it valuable, at two different times during the time that they were under Spain, Portuguese galleys or galleons in the east, they were captured. And one was captured by the Dutch, and it was an amount of money suitable to recapitalize the entire Dutch East India Company. They basically paid off the debts of the company with one Portuguese ship. Similarly, an English ship captured a Portuguese ship again once they were under Spain in the Indian Ocean, and it was half the British treasury was on one ship. So if you're asking, is it valuable? The question is, yes, it's very valuable.
Yeah, their ships were full of valuable money.
Exactly. So the problem, as you elucidated, is that King Sebastian of Portugal, the beau chevalier, the ideal of knighthood, has not had a wife and therefore no heir. He tried to marry a bunch of different princesses and things. One of the most fun is Margaret of Valois. He proposed to her, but he proposed to her after he had rejected her suit earlier because he didn't think she was Catholic enough. And I think she took that personal because she married a different guy. But anyway, he keeps proposing to princesses too late or wrong. And so he doesn't ever get a queen, but he does get the idea. He's going to go on crusade in Morocco and he's going to conquer Morocco and settle that hash for all time.
And if you think it's weird that there's a crusade in the Age of Empire instead of in the medieval era, one of the reasons you want to conquer Morocco at this point is that it would extend their big trade empire because the trade routes in Africa are there. So it's colonial as well as faith-based or allegedly faith-based.
Yeah, I mean, the Moroccan sultan had taken over other Portuguese ports on the Atlantic coast of Morocco, leaving them only Tangier and Ceuta and a couple of other places on the northern coast by the Strait of Gibraltar. And the other thing is that if you conquer the grain producing part of Morocco, you can feed those forts instead of making them ship their food across from Portugal. And finally, Morocco is sitting on the gold route into West Africa. Now, the Portuguese have already begun to close that off by having factories and colonies in West Africa, but it's nice to have both ends of the gold route. I think everyone can agree with that. So there's lots of reasons to invade Morocco, but there are few reasons to invade Morocco with 18,000 guys when you're going to face an army of 60,000 at the Battle of Alcazar Quibir. And he, in fact, does exactly that. And we don't know what happened to him, but he does not come back from the battle. He is Portugal's famous lost king. He's in a mountain somewhere, and he'll emerge from the fog when Portugal needs him most. That's what everyone says, and who am I to say? But he so far has not emerged.
And then he'll invade another place that he's outmatched against, and then they'll put him back in.
Yep, that's right. Yeah, when the aliens attack Portugal, he'll go to conquer Mars. But anyway, he did not emerge in 1580 when they needed him most to not turn Portugal into an appanage of the Spanish crown. His great uncle Henry inherits in 1578, but the downside of great uncle Henry is he's a cardinal of the church. And so he can't really say, oh, I've got a kid. That's uncool. So he dies in 1580. And Philip II, who has a descent from Manuel I of Portugal through the female line, says, well, the female line's not good enough for normal times. But what about when I have an army in Lisbon? Does it work for those times? And the Portuguese say, yes. He also then pays off the ransom for all the Portuguese nobles that are still held in Morocco, and that's a great way to get them on side. So he winds up king of Spain and king of Portugal, the Habsburg monarchy, and the Iberian Union, which is what they call it, is the personal union of crowns, and it lasts for, I think, three Philips, or at least two Philips. It goes from 1580 to 1640, and during this period, since Portuguese possessions are now Spanish possessions, everyone who hates the Spains goes and attacks them. And that's, of course, the Dutch and the English. As previously noted, the Dutch attack Portuguese possessions such as Brazil, Angola, Ceylon, and the East Indies. It doesn't take in the first two cases, but in the second two cases, it absolutely does. And so Portugal's generally neglected. Its population drops considerably from about 1.5 million to about a million during the period of the Union. That's not good. Basically, there you go. Portugal becomes a backwater. It emerges independent after a lengthy struggle in 1640, which is sort of part of the 30 Years' War, but there's no reason to get into that. And then they basically are nothing much but a staging ground for the English to invade Spain every now and again. And they're happy to do it. And they make port wine and they keep their few colonies until the 70s. And that's Portugal in our timeline.
Right. So let's skip for the moment the question of whether this ought to be done and see how you would do it. So how would you change the timeline?
Well, I mean, the easy fix is to, you know, get Sebastian married off. And I don't know if that's, you know, come up with, well, Margaret of Valois was very, very mean to the Protestants. I don't know what you're talking about, Sebastian. Here's a rotogravure of her beating on John Calvin's skull with an axe. That seems very mean.
Yeah. Or just whisper in his ear and tell him not to screw it up the first time.
Yeah. Don't mess it up, dude. And so you marry him off, you get him a kid, problem solved. Now, Portugal haters online will say, Sebastian was from a particularly bonsai version of a family tree in that he only has four great grandparents. And so you think the Habsburgs are inbred. Ho, ho, wait till you meet the House of Aviz. And also maybe Sebastian was sublimating some stuff when he was going on crusades and was not going to be having kids regardless. So your backup plan, I think Sebastian can pull it together. Me, I'm a pro-Sebastian guy. I don't want to get any mean letters from Portuguese. But the backup plan is Duarte, the Duke of Guimaras, who is the grandson of Manuel I, and therefore in direct line. He dies in 1576 unmarried, mostly because he's super depressed that Sebastian hates his guts. But get him married with an heir or two, and then, you know, doesn't matter how depressed he is. You keep him living past 1580, and suddenly he's king of Portugal, and that's nice. So either way, you need an heir for somebody, and whether it's the problem child Sebastian or mopey Duarte, someone, you've got to spend a lot of money on chocolate and strawberries in this time machine operation is what I'm telling you.
Right. So what does the effect on the timeline of preserving Portuguese independence look like.
All right. So to begin with, remember that empire? Well, they keep it. The only reason they lost it is because the Spanish were busy not defending it. Portugal keeps Malacca. Speaking of important straits that everyone should own, the island of Amboina, the Dutch massacre of Amboina doesn't happen. It's still Portuguese Amboina in the East Indies. They keep Hormuz. They were fighting off the Persians and the Ottomans together, even under the Spanish, and they could certainly do it under their own kingdom. They keep Ceylon, Sri Lanka today. They keep Bombay. That began as a Portuguese factory. The name is Bombaina, a beautiful bay. And so, they keep Bombay, which is handy. And remember, they kept Goa on the further south in India until 1961. So there's no reason they're losing Bombay. They kept their African colonies until 1976, and they kept Macau until 1999. So they keep all of those things. And then if the Portuguese Empire of the East follows the same logistical logic as the Dutch, eventually they figure out we should settle Cape Town. The Dutch did it around 1650. The Portuguese might have done it earlier if they aren't being distracted by a bunch of nonsense. And that is where you suddenly change global history, because the Portuguese, they're nobody's ideal colonial overlords, certainly, but they are going to create an entirely different kind of relationship with the black population of Africa. Because again, in Brazil, in Angola, in Cape Verde, the Portuguese are in a demographic crunch. There's like, as I mentioned, maybe 1.5 million Portuguese. They don't care where new Portuguese people come from. You know, intermarry, please, have a lot of kids. We need them to run this very, very wealthy, very, very undermanned empire. And so a big Portuguese South Africa, again, you can look at the history of Angola and Mozambique and say there's going to be some downsides, but it's not going to be an apartheid state the way that it was when it was run by the Dutch and then the British. That's just not going to happen. With no wars with England, they stay true to the ancient alliance of Portugal and England, which goes back to the 14th century. So they don't lose their colonies. Again, Bombay becomes English because Catherine of Braganza has to, when she marries into the English royal family, she brings it as her dowry. So that doesn't happen. They rely on the English factories at Penkulin in Sumatra, at Ternate in the Moluccas, and the English are their allies against the Spanish. They hated Spanish or any nosy Dutch. And again, the Dutch begin their colonial empire because the King of Spain closes off the Portuguese colonial empire to their traders. The Portuguese don't have the manpower to run everything, so they're happy to sell everything onto the Dutch for distribution in Northern Europe. The Dutch are like the Portuguese, you know, regional trade reps in Europe. And the Dutch would have no reason to go invade Portuguese territory if the Portuguese are still cutting them in for their retailers 40% or whatever it is. Now, when you asked this question, or rather Time Incorporated asked this question, I did know that the Portuguese had the occasional fishing post in Newfoundland and Nova Scotia, and I would love to have created Portuguese Canada just for you. But again, I just don't think the demographics are there.
Right.
The French are still going to come down the St. Lawrence. They're still going to try messing around. And the French don't have any old alliance with the Portuguese, rather the opposite. And so maybe Nova Scotia gets taken away from them by the French. Maybe they keep parts of it. Maybe they keep their, because they're just there to protect the cod fisheries. They don't really care about expanding inward and getting furs. So maybe what we have is like a Macau, but in Nova Scotia somewhere, or in Newfoundland somewhere, or on like Prince Charlotte Island is still Portuguese.
Well, I'm happy to stick with the current way that we got Portuguese people in Toronto, which was a mass migration in the 1950s. So right, just the other day, I had a delicious natta. I had a lovely egg custard tart, and I can rub shoulders with all the Portuguese people I want. So exactly. I don't need the maritime ones to do that.
Portuguese, you don't need weird Portuguese sea shanties coming out of Nova Scotia. But anyway, that's what basically happens. I think the big twist is South Africa is vastly different. I think that the Portuguese keep a hold of more of India for longer. They keep a hold of the East Indies. So the Portuguese are not really the go out and conquer everything type guys in the East. They do try to conquer parts of Angola. Basically, when you're running a place, it turns out none of the Africans show up to be enslaved. So you have to go find new Africans. That dynamic is going to continue. I was trying to figure out a way that they could ally with their former client state, the Kingdom of the Congo, but the same pressure is going to happen whether they're independent or under Spain. So we don't get Portugal's buddy, the Congo. We get Portugal's enemy, the Congo, just like we did in our history. And Portuguese are going to continue to expand into Brazil, maybe not as far, given that one of the reasons they kept going deep into the Amazon was it didn't matter what the Treaty of Tordesillas lined, which is through about the eastern third of Brazil, says, if you're still technically under Spain. And then once you're the enemy of Spain, you certainly don't care what the treaty says. So maybe Portuguese Brazil is more clumped up on the eastern third and less into the Amazon. And either there's an extensive protectorate or the Spanish eventually go over the Andes or down the Orinoco and take some big chunk of the Amazon for themselves, which becomes independent in 1820 with the rest of Spanish Latin America. So that's Portugal right there. That's what goes on. Maybe they even still have Brazil. It devolves into a commonwealth instead of having their monarchy flee to it to avoid Napoleon. I suppose it's also possible their monarchy can still flee to it to avoid Napoleon, because Napoleon isn't going to ignore Portugal, rather the opposite. But there you go. That's, I think, the big change is South Africa, assuming the Portuguese follow the logic of going around the Cape of Good Hope every few months. And the rest is Indonesia is slightly better off. More of it is under local control for longer, and less of it is being massacred by the Dutch in Java. So there we are.
Well, even a somewhat softened colonialism saves a lot of lives.
It does. And not to ding the Dutch, but I think the food is better as a result.
And gaming-wise, you could have a sort of an interesting, slightly unfamiliar alternate world that is recognizable, yet still different enough to be able to play with and not worry about history as we know it. And I think that could be a fun, different setting for a fiction or a game. And on that note, I think we can once again pronounce our job done and then head off to perhaps some Brazilian delicacies and come back a mere week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/CanAndRobin.
Keep this podcast independent from the Spanish crown alongside such backers as
Ethan Mr. E. Schoonover,
Jack Ulick,
Michael Dowman,
Tech Keela,
and David Flisk.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindelaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.